So the million-dollar question, what is it like settling in Australia? So this is actually a very complex question. So I'll try and do a simple breakdown into two categories. So there's the social and there's the professional. Both tend to be affected by similar things. Of course, we're going to mention racism for sure, but there are differences. So let's begin with socially. So when I came here, we were in high school. So pretty much settling here is how would you put this? It's a very meritocratic society in the sense of if you are spectacular, right? If you're really, really outstanding in some way, shape or form, you will find your way socially, right? So what I mean by that is if you're very tall, if you're very charismatic, if you're very talented as a musician, if you have some talent that this society values or some attribute, height, athletic ability, stuff like that, you will fit in socially very, very quickly, right? And race will still be a factor for sure. You'll still encounter racism, but racism will be more of a perennial nuisance as opposed to something that defines your experience of being here. So that's if you're spectacular in some way, right? Now, if you're just ordinary, usually the paths to being accepted, I mean, they're pretty much from there, they just get limited, right? Because you're not really someone that's valued by the society here, you know, because you're an African and because of your race, people don't presume you have much to offer, really. So socially, like if you're not spectacular, your options begin to get limited. Either you fall into one of the stereotypes that they'd want you to fall into. You know, you could play more into African-American stereotypes. And I have friends who've gone down that route, you know, gotten the full American accent, you know, dressed like that, lived that lifestyle completely. And they got social benefits here and there from that. The other way you could go is, you know, again, because you're an African and people perceive you as being at the bottom of the totem pole of humanity, people who would be considered as losers or the marginalized tend to gravitate to you, right? So you will not struggle to get friends, but you're not going to be hobnobbing with, like, you know, the creme de la creme. You'll be hobnobbing with people who also feel like they're outsiders. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're losers, right? So a lot of the time you'll be hobnobbing with people who are outsiders, who really, you know, are spectacular people. But still, it's for you to really crack into the mainstream society. I can't really say I know anyone who has. I'm sure there are people who have, but I can't really say I know anyone who has. More often than not, what you tend to find is either, you know, you get accepted by, you come in, you're spectacular in some way, and you're given your place, right? So, you know, we're talking about, you'll hang around, like, let's say you're tall, you're an athlete or you're a musician, you know, there'll be social events for you where you'll have your friends that you'll hang out with, you'll have, you know, the women that'll be interested in you and stuff like that. So there's social events for you. There are pre-selected places, pre-selected social events that organize around, you know, hip hop culture, around, you know, dance, around basketball, stuff like that. And so you'll select from that culture. So that's if you're spectacular and have something. Whereas if you are not, generally you'll tend to find yourself hanging around people who either are considered or consider themselves outcasts. And as long as you're comfortable with that, I think you'll be fine. So if you come here somehow thinking that you can kind of conquer the place and, you know, get to the very top, I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to come here and say it's not possible, but I will say it is extremely difficult. And to penetrate into the mainstream society is extremely difficult. Are there any skills that one can transfer from Kenyan society to society like Australia? Yes. Number one is math and English. So the level of math and English that we tend to learn between the ages of 0 till about 14 and 15 is far and above what they learn here. So I remember I was watching, there's a UFC fighter. I mean, to go to my previous answer about people who are spectacular and they get their place in society, there's a UFC fighter who came, you know, also as a kid, lives in New Zealand. His name is Israel Adesanya. People might know about him, but for those who don't, he fights in the United States for Ultimate Fighting Championship. He's 30 years old. came from Nigeria, very Nigerian, both Nigerian parents. And, you know, now he's a global superstar, right? So I remember watching his interview, and he talked about how when he first got to school, they put him in the bottom class for math. And he went there and he was confused because he was like, is this what you're learning in math? I learned this, you know, years ago. And within a couple of classes, he'd been moved to the top class. And I remember laughing because that was exactly my experience. Got brought into high school, put in the bottom class for math and English. And within, I think, 2 days, I was in the top class for both. Because, like, our level of math and English is so much higher. I don't know if this question will be asked, so I'll pretty much answer this now. Where you begin to see Westerners begin to pull away is around, because I came here in my Inform 2, essentially. So I came in Inform 2, year 10. So where I really began to see people break away is that from around year 10, you begin to learn two things. How to reason and how to discern the media. Actually, three things. And the other one is abstract thinking. Actually, four things, and creative thinking. So I remember, you know, some of the things we were learning is we'd be given a newspaper and we'd be told, break this newspaper down. What's the agenda of this paper? What message are they trying to convey? What tools are they using? You know, you'd understand things like rhetorical questions. You'd understand things like framing and stuff like that. Just begin to understand how the newspapers shape how they want you to think. And we're doing that in high school. The other thing is, you know, as a kid, you get told things like, and this happens much earlier. This begins maybe at around 8 or 9, maybe even 5. Actually, probably, I don't even know, because I just remember seeing this from my sister from very young. You begin to be told, okay, pick an animal and go and put together a creative, compelling presentation around this topic. And then you begin to get critiques about your ability to communicate, your ability to convey messages. So like a lot of these things, actually 5, yeah, I didn't even mention communication, which is huge here. So like you really start to get taught, I think in essence it's soft skills and emotional and thinking skills, right? So you begin to really learn how to reason and think and how to communicate and convince. And that's where people really begin to pull away. But I think as far as the things that you have to learn, like through rote, you know, math, English, I think we tend to come in much higher. Number two, the other thing that we bring across is that, and, you know, the funny thing is I think this will change post-corona, but I think one of the things we really took for granted that we had as an advantage as African people, two of them really are our religious grounding and our family. So what those two things do is they really, the family grounding kind of gives you those two things, part of what they give you is they give you a purpose outside of yourself that you can push through for even when things get tough. Because life here can get tough, life here can get very lonely, you can feel very marginalized, very alone. But, you know, if you have a relationship with God and if you have a relationship with your family, you know, usually you don't suffer as much because you know you're pushing through the suffering for a reason. So I'd say those are advantages that sometimes don't get enough flack. The other thing that we tend to have a bit more of, I mean, our work ethic is decent, right? So our work ethic is okay relative to other cultures. I'd just say it's okay because there are cultures that are far and above our level of work ethic. But I think if you compare us with the normal, everyday kind of European, I would say our work ethic is comparatively somewhat better. What other skills would I say we bring in? I think I'd say if you can run a business in Kenya, you can run a business here, no problem. If you have what it takes to grow a business in Kenya, then you definitely have what it takes to grow a business in a place like Australia. You know, those skills, I mean, translate extremely well here. You know, that grit, determination, the ability to kind of, you know, come up with solutions on the fly, taking full ownership of your job, things of that nature. So those skills also do translate very well. I think those are the first that come to mind. All right, another $1 million question. How do I navigate the racial complexity of society? So here is where I will say God has been extremely good and generous to me, because fortunately, for the most part, I really don't. Even though I live in Australia, I can't really say I interact with Australians very much for anything. So if you look at my work, again, I run essentially a technical college. Almost all my staff are from non-English backgrounds. Almost all my students are from non-English backgrounds. So it's pretty much immigrants working with immigrants 90% of the time. And look, to be honest, unfortunately, when I do interact with Europeans, I would say 8 times out of 10, it goes pretty badly. 8 times out of 10, it goes pretty badly. Actually, I guess this is an insight that very few people would ever have. My parents run businesses here. I run a business here. So we've been doing business since we showed up business people. We've continued business people. I think this is what, a third generation entrepreneur. So this is what we've done, right? We do business, right? And I can tell you, it's a real struggle for Europeans to have an African as a boss. It's a real struggle for them. Psychologically, they don't cope very well with it. They don't like it. They don't enjoy it. We also don't work well together, not just because of that racial component, but the cultural component as well. One thing I would say is that the culture matters more than the race, right? Because the reason that's very important is because, as an example, I work with Russians. I feel very comfortable working. My accountant for the last 5 to 6 years has been a Russian. White, blue eyes, we work very well together because our cultural background feels more similar. Because we've both come from a background where if you don't work hard or if things don't work out the right way, you could be poor and living in material suffering. So there's kind of a shared understanding of that. We've both seen that. We've both grown up around, having to work hard, right? Whereas one of the big general cultural differences tends to be, and this is how you can usually tell, regardless of someone's color, whether they've grown up here, is whether or not they expect that the world exists for their comfort and convenience. Do they somehow think that things should work a certain way, that things should go a certain way? And so those people who tend to have those kind of expectations, we don't tend to work very well. So I'll give you an example, actually. This one I might ramble on a bit, but, I don't think you're going to get many other people who are going to talk about this particular topic, so why not? So I remember in my business, I had a HR manager about like 5 years ago, and she was an Australian, right? Nice lady. Her name was Sarah. Very, very nice lady. I really have nothing. Even though things didn't work out very well, I think this was more the cultural incongruence, as you'll hear. So pretty much the primary argument we had all the way until she left was, should you build a business built around serving the customer first? So as a staff member, you're willing to sacrifice your time, your resources for the service of the customer or for the service of the company's goals. Like, is that the highest value you should aspire towards? Or she thought we should build a company where we nurture and build the staff first. So basically, you have staff events, you have staff dinners, you have regular staff lunches, you have, regular motivational talks, regular fun. Like, you really build a great workplace to come to. And whereas for me, my thinking at the time, I think I'm a bit more balanced now, but back then, coming from the background I came from, I was like, no, I don't want people who I have to babysit. I don't want people who I have to be the one to motivate them to come to work. I still believe that, but I do understand that even if you get people who are innately hardworking now, you do have to kind of motivate them and make things fun and enjoyable to some extent. So I am a bit more sympathetic to that viewpoint, but I would say still, I'm still more of that viewpoint. I'd say I'm 60% of the viewpoint that you should get people who are just self-motivated and then give them the goals, as opposed to you should get people and make your primary purpose as a manager to motivate them, right? So kind of those are the kind of the things, and that seems like to people who are outside of business, that'll seem like like nonsense. It'll seem like a nonsense conversation. But I can tell you, the way that plays out is night and day. As far as, like, she came out thinking I was this kind of callous, spoiled person. And I came out thinking she was very flighty and not really understanding the grounding that it takes for business. Again, still, I liked her a lot and it was great working with her. But you do tend to find those kind of differences. Professionally, I would say it's been extremely difficult when I've had to interact with them. It's one of those things where, I mean, it's at the end of the day, you always hire on merit. So if they're the best person for the job, you hire them. I mean, regardless of previous experiences. But it is that difficult, I can say. Now for the professional, I can only give what I've heard because I haven't had a job for about 14 years now. So I can only give you my friends' experiences, and they do say yes. People here are very racially insensitive and also racially blind. So I think they think because they have America to contrast themselves against that they're doing much, much better. But people here generally do tend to have they do have a sense of racial superiority for sure, but they're not aware of it, right? So one of the things that tends to happen is when you do begin to discuss race issues, people here get very angry and very defensive. And the conversation here becomes about them just proving to themselves that they're not racist. Irrespective of their actions, irrespective of their what they might have said or done, they just want the stamp. They just want the rubber stamp somehow that I'm not racist. Once they have the rubber stamp, they're through with you. Like, they're through with that conversation. All they want is a stamp, they move on. They really have no interest in challenging the way they think, challenging the way they act. They kind of think that the way they do things is the best. They think they should be able to go and make racially insensitive jokes because their intentions are good. If you take it badly, whatever, because my intentions were good. Even though if you start to point out that, you know, maybe your intentions are coming from a background of a sense of racial superiority, they won't want that. And again, you'll end up in this place where they just want to be defensive and want the rubber stamp of not being racist. They do tend to be quite racist as far as, yeah, the way you get treated as work. Racism definitely factors into it. Like the stories you hear, it's definitely a huge factor. It's a huge detriment, and it's one of those things where I think we've not, as African people, we really haven't come together to start figuring this thing out, and it's probably one of the things that we need to start figuring out. So now let's move to the broader culture. Yes, it's also a huge factor. So something that started within the last 5 years is, so there's a lot of Sudanese refugees here. And it's a true shame because their parents tend to be absolute sweethearts. Like, Sudanese parents are amazing human beings. But their children, for whatever reason, I don't know how it ended up this way, but they just come out, end up these loud, abrasive people who just are, you know, just troublemakers, essentially. Just troublemakers, right? So, and a lot of them, you know, do stuff like fighting, petty crime, stuff like that. Which now, to be fair, that is something I've been hearing about for a lot of racial groups since I showed up here. Russians were doing it, the Turkish were doing it, Lebanese were doing it. But once the Sudanese started doing it, it got special because Sudanese people, tall, dark. So they over the last 5 years, the media here started focusing on African gangs, even though they're only responsible for 2% of the crime. And of course, that has played into the myths and the stereotypes a lot of people here have. So socially, a lot of people do view us through the lens of African Americans, right? So they view us through the lens they're given by the United States. So they do think of us as, you know, innately criminals, innately rapists, especially as us men. And so that does factor in, you know. So like for me, I can say the thing I hate the most about living in this country is walking down the street and having to walk past a woman. I mean, she'll grab her bag, she'll start to get nervous, and that happens to me a lot. So it's usually one of the ways I can tell that I'm back home. If I walk past a woman and she just walks past me, she doesn't have any reaction. So it is a huge problem. So if you saw the Black Lives Matter here in Australia, a lot of it was factored on how we tend to be treated socially, because it is quite bad. It is quite bad, and we still have a long way to go. yeah, I think I've gone on enough about that. How do we keep abreast of news from home? This one is short and easy. The answer you expect, social media, pretty much. So WhatsApp being number one, and WhatsApp groups being number one, and then number two being things like Facebook and stuff like that. Though less so Facebook. I'd say more so, really, WhatsApp and YouTube. Yeah. How do we process Kenyan news from so far away? There's an article, I think it was Biko Zulu who wrote it, about how when people tend to come from overseas, they tend to be very scared, right? When they first arrive, putting their money in their socks, being extremely paranoid. Now, a lot of why that happens is because what tends to be news, what we tend to get as news for the entire time we're away is the bad news, right? So you usually don't have the nuances of good news. Like very rarely are you overseas and people are telling you good things. Unfortunately, you know, if your family's reaching out to you, it's because they need money for this. If you're talking about something on WhatsApp, it's because something has gone wrong. So if you, part of why people, when people first go home, they tend to be quite paranoid is for that reason. It's because all you've heard is bad news. So it takes you a while to kind of recalibrate and figure out, you know, what are the good spaces, what are the bad spaces, how bad is it, how paranoid should I really be, you know, and that kind of thing. Other than that, so for me it's a bit different because, you know, again, I'm back and forth. So for me, though I was talking about this with my mom recently, because this is the longest I've been away from home. I think I've been gone now for 4 months. This is the longest I've been away from home. Since 2015. No. Actually, I was gone for a while, for 6 months. But usually if I'm gone for more than a few months, I begin to lose my, there's a certain level of chaos that you have to be comfortable with to live in Kenya, right? A certain level of understanding and expecting that things will go wrong. That you have to be comfortable with to live in Kenya. And as you live in the West, the longer you live here, the more you get used to things just being stable, everything being on time, people showing up to meetings on time, you know, you'd get too used to how efficient the place is. So you tend to get a bit soft So for me, yeah, that's one of the reasons I don't like being away from home for too long is because I need to be back home where things are a bit chaotic. Because it takes me longer to get used to being home than it does to being here. Especially, again, because as I answered my previous question, I don't really interact with race issues very often, if at all, here. Here, I'm mainly around immigrants, Africans, and stuff like that. So socially, I'm okay adjusted, right? I still don't like being here very long because I like a place where when I go to the shop, I feel comfortable in the shop. I don't feel like I'm being profiled in the shop. Where when I walk down the street, I don't feel like the women are scared of me and stuff like that. That's one of the things I like about being at home. So, but again, in the spaces that I tend to spend most of my time, which is home and work, I'm very comfortable when I'm here. So I like to be home where, you know, every space has chaos, just so that I can be used to it. Because now if I stay here for too long, it'll take me, you know, a few months to get home and just kind of recalibrate to, you know, how much chaos should I expect? How much should I expect things to go wrong? What are the good spaces? What are the bad spaces? Where can I go? How should I travel at night? And that kind of thing. Yeah. My relationship with their local events, local culture, relationships, and as far as residency. Okay, so I can begin with residency. We came here as permanent residents and then became citizens. So I've pretty much always been, I've been comfortable here as far as residency and that kind of thing from the very beginning, and that's continued. So yeah, that one has not really been anything I've questioned. Now I've had to do it for my newborn daughter and for my wife. And so I'm learning, it does take time, it does take effort, it does take, you know, a lot of time. You know, as I said, my wife's visa has been rejected twice. The third one I applied by myself, and the application process took me, I don't know, maybe, 40 to 60 hours to put together all the paperwork. And that's only because I had a lot of this stuff on my computer, you know, because I had to go and, you know, I had to, again, as I told you, we had to write our love story. We had to attach messages. We had to attach joint bank statements. We had to attach statements about our child. We had to attach health insurance information for our child, birth certificate, stuff like that. So I'm only fortunate that a lot of this stuff I already had. But if I didn't have it, I mean, we might be talking like 2 to 4 weeks just to apply for her to come and visit. And I expect the partner visa will be much, much longer than that. So, you know, it's a difficult process dealing with your residency. And I know for a lot of people here, it's quite nerve-wracking. Like one of my groomsmen could not come to my wedding because of visa issues. So until you get to the permanent residence line, it is quite nerve-wracking and quite difficult. But again, for me, you know, again, God was good. We showed up as permanent residents, so it's not really been much of an issue to me. Local events and local culture, I'm completely out of touch, completely. I watch TV here and there. But outside of that, I have no idea. I don't go to sports. I go to fight events when they come. And that's about the most interaction I get. But outside of that, yeah, pretty much I'm just around other Africans, around other, immigrants and stuff like that. So I really wouldn't know. Relationships. So the friends that I had, the friendship circle that I had in Brisbane, everyone kind of fragmented and to a large extent went their own way. I'm no longer in Brisbane, so I don't interact with that social circle much anymore. Occasionally here and there, but for the most part, we don't interact much. Romantic relationships, yeah, pretty much. I talk about this all the time. I was not wanted by women here, of the local culture here at all. I wasn't even wanted by Africans here. So for relationships, they did not go well, pretty much, to put it lightly. So yeah, nothing really major there. I'm married now, so I don't really know, because I don't go anywhere or do anything, so I don't know what it would be like now, but I just know, yeah, it wasn't platonic or romantic. Yeah, I was pretty much useless to people here. Yeah, and I think that answers all the questions, so thank you, and bye-bye.